Mr. Day, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Day?
I was born in Nottingham on June 1st, 1920.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a baker on Stenton Road in Nottingham, first in West Street in 1911, and then he moved up Stenton Road in 1918, just after the First World War.
Was he in the First World War? Did he
was in the First War for a certain length of time, but he was discharged, being medically unfit. He had an illness during the First World War.
How many were there in the family? Did you have any brothers and sisters?
He had 15 brothers and sisters. There were 16 altogether. They originated from Ashla in Hertfordshire, where my second cousin is a baker to this day. There were 9 male members of the family and 7 female members of the family. And strange enough, they all lived. But that time of day, people didn't all live. The health benefits weren't the same as they are today. But they all lived, and they became doctors, nurses, and worked for Whitbreads, all in good line of business.
That was your father's family.
That's my father's family.
And how many in...
She was, before she married my father, she was a school teacher. She was a headmistress at Sandon, near Ashwell. That's where she met my father. She had 5 brothers and sisters. She had 3 sisters and 2 brothers.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, I was the only one.
And was it a fairly comfortable upbringing in the Stanton area?
Not really. We were in the slums of Nottingham. In my early youth, I was continuously getting into fights. That was the sort of area we lived in. Holding somebody's woman's jug while she had a fight, you know, that sort of area.
You were living in a slum area, but your parents were better off than that, were they?
No, the parents had got a bakery in the slum area, in West Street, on Stenton Road.
So they were better off. I mean, your own family...
They were better off than the majority of normal working class people at that time, inasmuch as they were sort of masters of their own business. They were bakers, mastermen.
So you were reasonably clothed and fed
yourself? Oh, yes.
And what school did you go to?
I went to Stenton Trust. From 5 years until 11 years old, and then I went to Bedford, Rushmore School, Bedford, which was a preparatory school for Bedford Modern and Bedford School, on Shakespeare Road in Bedford. And then I was there until I was 16, when my mother died suddenly, and I had to leave there. It was a boarding school away from home, and I went to the London High School when I was 13.
So. What did you specialise in at school? Did you have any particular interests?
I used to like Latin. Latin is a language, as dead as Ed can be. I like Latin. I wasn't an academic boy at all. I liked sport, cricket, football, boxing, rowing, rugby football, name it, I did.
Did you have any interest in the OTC, if they had one?
No, none whatsoever.
Did they have one?
They had one at the high school, yes, but not at Bedford.
And what were you planning to do when you left school as you got older, you know?
Well, I did really when I left school because my mother died and I had to go help my father in the bakery business, but I had some leanings toward medicine. I did want to do medicine. I wanted to become a doctor.
What had attracted you to medicine?
I wanted to help people. I wanted to do, if I saw anything injured, anything that wanted help in any way, I wanted to do that, to help them. That was my leaning towards the, if you like, towards the human race.
And so the OTC would have been the other side of things,
that was, I didn't
causing think injury rather than...
That's right, yes.
Were you able to pursue your interest in medicine at all? I mean...
Not until I went into, when I joined the South Knots Hussars as a territorial, yes, but not before, no.
So, what about when you actually left school? What, you were helping your father in the bakery, but what did you actually do as a job?
As a job. I used to get up in the morning and help the bakers make the bread and bake it. And then he used to go to my horse and see was fed and so forth, because I used to deliver in a horse and cart. And about 8 o'clock in the morning, I fetched the van down from the garage, the two vans. We had two horse-drawn vans. And packed my van, bread, cakes, put my horse in, 9 o'clock I would set off in the morning. At that time, I continued, the first half an hour walk, because the van was full to capacity. I'd got about 20 shops, small shops, street corners, and about, I don't know, I can't remember exactly, about 100, possibly 150, 140, something like that, private customers. I'd come home at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and have a bit of dinner and off again until 6, 7 o'clock at night, probably 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. And of course, we had to deliver bread for Saturday, for the weekend, for Saturday and Sunday.
And you were doing that from about 1936?
37. About 1937 to 1939. I was called up on the 1st of September, a Friday.
Now, what about in 1938? You joined the South Notts Hussars.
Yes.
Now, how did that come about? I mean, what made you decide to join the South Notts Hussars?
Well, Jamie went to Munich and had a meeting with Herr Hitler and Signore Mussolini and Monsieur de Lallier. The outcome of which, when he came back, he said, it's peace in our time. I think everyone knows that piece of paper we have at the airport. It's been seen a lot on television over the years. It was stipulated then that every man of 17 and over, 17 to 19 I believe it was, had to do 6 months compulsory military service. My father, having the baking business and me helping him, said he could not spare me for that length of time, therefore I must go and join a territorial unit.
Now, what made you choose the South Notts Hussars as opposed to one of the Nottingham regiments?
I went to Trinity Square and attempted to join a territorial unit there, and they told me they were full up. So I continued gently up Derby Road to the Derby Road drill hall. And passing the Derby Road drill hall, when a hand appeared and grabbed hold of me and pulled me in. And that was Peter Birkin, who became Major Peter Birkin, P.G. Birkin. And together with possibly another dozen, I was sworn in.
Well, why did he grab you? Did he know you then?
No, but I was sort of, I suppose, he must have thought that I was looking for employment. Yes, that's about it. Hmm.
And what was the procedure of joining? Do you remember the actual details you went through?
I put my hand on the Bible, swearing allegiance to the king and country. It's a long time ago. I don't think we received the king's shilling or anything like that, but I remember doing that, yes.
And did you know anything about the South Notts Hussars?
Nothing whatsoever. Nothing.
And what what were you joining as? I mean, most people joined as a gunner.
I joined as a gunner. I was a gun layer in 425 Battery, A Troop, the sergeant of who was Sergeant Inger. Gunger.
Now, you joined that day. Do you know the date you joined? Roughly, perhaps the month.
I would think, yes, sometime about June 38. It might have been, I can't exactly remember, no. Sometime in 38, but I think register was in about September 38. It must have been about June 38.
Right, and so you went in and joined. How did they kit you out? What uniform did they give you?
We had battle dress, tunics and trousers, and that's what I thought I remember having.
Now, what night was your drill night?
I can only remember going on a Sunday morning. Doing gun drill on a Sunday morning.
That's the only time you remember going?
The only time I can remember going.
So what would happen on when you went? What training did you get to start with?
We were trained to use and shoot a 25-pounder gun.
Wouldn't it be 18-pounder then?
I believe so, yes, it was. It's quite right, it was an 18-pounder. I think we changed to 25-pounders later on, yes.
And do you remember what that training consisted of? I know you didn't pursue that as a gunner, but do you remember what the training was like? what each person
was
trained.
I was trained to lay a gun, but I'd had very little training in that before the war broke out. I had very little training.
Do you remember what the 6-gun team did, what each person did in a gun team?
I'm not conversant really with it. I didn't do enough of it to be conversant.
So you were training, you don't remember a lot about it. Did you go to camp in 38?
I went to Reddersdale camp.
That was in 38?
Right.
And what do you remember about that camp?
We did firing, of course, and I think we fired for a prize or something. But no, I know it rained like crazy all the time pretty well, and I don't remember much about it. I didn't do much gun laying there. I didn't do much gun work there.
What about the conditions while you were out? Had you experienced being out in tents and things before, living rough?
No, but I had experienced living rough, yes. Yes, I had experienced, yeah. There's nothing new. Nothing new getting wet through or cold or anything like that. No, it's nothing new. I've been out shooting, poaching rabbits and things like that as a lad, and, you know, it's nothing really.
So you don't recall a lot about Reedsdale 38. So your training would go on for about a year, you'd be training, until you were called up.
Yes.
Is there anything else you remember about your training, the actual technical things?
Nope.
Right. What about the people you joined up with? Who were the people that most impressed you in the South Knots Hussars before the war started, while you were training? Were there any figures? You mentioned Sergeant Inger. What was he like?
Sergeant Inger, he was an older man than we were, probably could have been 7 or 8 years older. He was a nice man, nice chap, yes, all right. I remember Sergeant Jackie Brown, who was a very good gun sergeant.
What made a good gun sergeant? What would you say were the qualities you were looking for, as opposed to a bad sergeant?
Knowledge, and his ability to instill discipline.
How did they do that? Or was it by example? Or what?
By example, and of course by verbal training, what he got from the manual, and his own experiences, of course.
What about your officers? A troops officer at the time?
A troop officer at that time was... The 45 Battery Major was Major Hansen at that time. A Troop Battery Commander was Captain Hudson. Poor man, very nice man. He eventually came to live after the war in our village, if I allowed him, and in Holbringham, the next village up the road.
What was he like as an officer? Would you see much of him during training?
Not a lot, no. I didn't. No.
Any other officers you remember from before the war?
I remember Aggie Carr, who was the son of A.W. Carr, the Notts cricket captain. Peter Birkin always sort of gave me inspiration. He was a good officer, Peter Birkin. Well, they all were, as far as that goes, but of course he was in 425 Battery. Later, of course, I got to know all the officers.
We'll pick that up as we come through then. So, you went through your year's training. Do you remember anything about going to Reedsdale in 39?
No.
So that's vague with you. I think the best thing now is to move on to the outbreak of war. Did you see war coming yourself? I mean, did you follow international relations and the prospect of war?
I did, yes. One could see war coming, of course, yes.
What did you think of that? I mean, because it was going to involve you. You were in the territorials. I mean,
yes. Well, I think we all had the same thing. We all had an element of fear. Everybody, if you're going into war, you have a great chance of getting killed or wounded, as there's millions more. And young, I like athletes. I love cricket, football, rugby, football, anything, rowing. I would have sooner got killed. Well, that's not a very exciting prospect, but I sooner got killed than had my leg shot off or wounded. I couldn't pursue my normal sporting activities. It might sound self-centred, but that's how I felt at the time.
So what about your actual call-up? What do you recall of that?
I remember a telegram arriving when I walked the ball, to the Derby Road Bill Hall. I think it was by 5 o'clock on the Friday afternoon. I put my horse away, fed him, watered him, checked him, put my money in. My father took me in the motor van, which we had at the time of the airport, up to the Derby Road Bill Hall. We assembled in the hall. We were talked to by a Sergeant Major Burnett, who told us we now were in the regular army, no longer sort of territorials, and we sort of got to smarten ourselves up. And possibly this time tomorrow we might have been trenches in France, which shook me rigid. But there was a bombardier named Flint, Teddy Flint, E.E.E. Flint, very tall lad. And I can remember he sort of broke tension when he said, "Sergeant Major, sir." "Yes, bombardier." Are we proper soldiers now, Sergeant Major?" That gave me great boost, that hit.
So, what was the atmosphere like that day? You've mentioned that, I mean, the speech, but, I mean, did the mobilisation go efficiently that Friday night?
Went, as far as I know, it went very efficiently, and sort of when we got together and I met my own mates, we were quite happy. You know, I never long, no longer thought of getting killed or wounded or anything. We were together.
Who were your special friends at the start then?
Ray Ellis, Bob Foles, Bob Paulson, Patrick Bland, Bill Hutton, Jeff McLean. Those were the special ones, especially the first three, four, Patrick Bland. Yeah.
So those were the... And did you have a similar background?
Yes, well, Bob Foles, Bob Paulson and myself went to the Nottingham High School almost at the same time, yes.
Were you aware of any division? Because the South Notch is quite an interesting unit, because 425 Battery and 426 Battery were different, had a different recruiting composition. And also, even within 425, there were different sort of types of people in... Were you aware of any differences from background of people within the unit?
No, really, except the 426 Battery mainly concerned with miners. With Major Bob, of course, he was the owner of a coal mine at Moore Green, and a lot of the men there had been conscripted, enrolled from the mines, with a bunch of those mines, always.
Within 425, were you, I mean, one of the phrases that was looked at, and it wasn't used unpleasantly, I think, was the cut glass boys from the Nottingham High School. Were you aware of that sort of phrase or that sort of attitude?
I wasn't aware of any sort of social difference. No, I wasn't aware of that. Not at all. No.
Now, you were called up that. Where did you sleep that night?
I slept in the drill hall at Derby Road on a palliasse with no straw in it and a ground sheet. And I was told by Major Teddy Batt, the adjutant, among others, we were all there, and he said, "You'll have far worse billets than this before the war's over." And I can truthfully say I never did, because even the sands of the desert was warm and softer than that concrete floor.
And so you all slept in there together the first night? Or were you split up amongst...
Oh, yes, we were split up in various rooms in there. But I remember, I think it was A Troop who slept in this particular place. It was A Room in the drill hall.
Now, there was an air raid.
There was an air raid...
Warning that night.
An air raid warning.
What do you remember of that? Because that's...
Well, I was on sentry outside the drill hall at the time, and people, officers running about in pyjamas, and there was a bit of a flap on. But, of course, it was... So I think there were two warnings during the night, but it passed all right, and you know, we calmed down.
What was your that you'd been put on sentry?
Two on and four off, or something like that. Yes. Yeah.
And what was your duty as a sentry?
I just stood outside with a rifle. I remember during the night, I came a Saturday morning. I had been playing cricket on the Thursday, prior to being called up on the Friday, I'd been playing cricket against the post office on Trent Bridge Cricket Ground. And Bernard Bradley, who was a telegraph boy, and sort of he passed the time of day every time he brought telegrams to the South Park, to the drill hall. Important telegrams, I don't know what. Also, I remember a very funny thing, a man named Bill Lake, who had at that time a rather spacious car, it was an MG Magna. Terrific, got a radio in it. Not many cars have got a radio at that time, I think. And they were in carpets, Lake's carpets. And he was a Yorkshire fellow. He was rather like, you know, the old comedian named Sandy Powell years ago. And I remember him coming up and putting his nose in about 3 inches of mine. I was sort of like a statue with a rifle, and as a sentry should be, in concern. And he said, "Hey, Harry, lad, that does look bloody funny like that." So I'd been playing cricket with him only sort of a couple of days before. And I said to him, "Oh, I'd say, bugger off, Bill." I was embarrassed.
So, was there any proper air raid precautions you were meant to? Was there anything real that had been done about air raids, or was it?
Well, we did have a Bren gun manned by Stanway and Frank Knowles on top of the drill hall. I think it was a Bren gun, I wouldn't be certain. It was a gun of some description which would have been used as an anti-aircraft gun. Not much better, I suppose, but because it had been too high. But I remember that about it.
Had there been any slit trenches dug at that early stage?
I don't recall any, no.
And what happened the next day then? Or during the next couple of days?
The next day, well, Saturday, I was given... the doctor wanted a medical order. Dr. Lloyd Davis. I applied and got the job.
Now, you'd applied... presumably because of your long-standing interest.
I was interested in medicine. I thought if I can get somewhere I can help somebody, there's going to be a war. If I can do something regarding helping people, I will do this. I got the job and I had to...
Were there many people applied?
Yes, there was another lad who got another job with me. There was two of us, Baker, Spud Baker. I think he afterwards took a commission.
And what sort of interview or test did you have? Because you might not have been suitable to be a medical orderly. I mean, how did Dr. Davis sort of decide?
I didn't have any tests at all. I mean, nobody asked me to tie a certain knot or do a certain type of bandage. I just got the job on face value.
They didn't interview you or anything?
No, I was told to clean out this medical inspection room in this factory, which I did, and then I was told I could have the rest of the afternoon and evening off and report back next morning on Sunday morning. So I went back to the bakery, my horse was ready, the van was loaded, and in my army uniform, I started to deliver bread again, where I left off. And I was young, popular, and about midnight at that particular night we came down Stanton Dale, having done Bakersfield Estate and Oakdale Road and Skipton Circus and Ipswich Circus, and was all closed, and people had been giving me, give him half a pint, we shan't see him again, give the horse some of them, give us a bottle of beer, and I don't know who was drunk in charge of who, whether the horse was drunk in charge of me, I was drunk in charge of the horse. So there's one thing for certain, you'd have had no difficulty in getting a urine sample from him. That is perfectly true. Great.
So you were now the medical orderly. You got back that night.
I went back on the Sunday morning.
Sunday morning.
Yes.
And you were. What was the medical setup that you were joining? I mean, Lloyd Davis would be the regimental doctor, would he?
He was a regimental MO. Yes, he was an analytical chemist at Boots. And of course, in the first instance, all the men had to be given tetanus toxoid, an antigen against tetanus, which occurs before you get a wound. ATS is given, anti-tetanus serum is given when you've got them. And they also had to be vaccinated against smallpox.
Straight away?
They all had it before they left England at various stages. I believe I'm right in saying we started at the drill hall. We did some at the drill hall. Vaccination.
And what was the procedure? Was it just one injection with both, or was it two separate injections?
Between the calf lymph, which was the smallpox injection, was given separately from the tetanus toxoid injection, because tetanus toxoid consisted of half a cc followed in 10 days' time by one cc, and that should have given immunisation. Well, it was said at the time lifelong, but it is not true. It wasn't lifelong, but it was over many years. And the other one, the calf lymph, smallpox, that should have given immunisation for lifetime.
And what was the procedure for giving the injections?
Well, the procedure for giving the calf lymph against smallpox was to take a small, sharp needle, rather like a very minute scalpel, and to draw plasma, not blood corpuscles, if that was possible. And then one got a pipette, a very fine pipette, and blew. Mind you, the whole area had to be sterilised before with surgical spirit. And then the lymph was blown, allowed to dry, and a dressing, a plaster was placed over it.
So the lymph was blown into this very superficial wound that you'd made with a scalpel, like.
That's right. The lymph was contained in a very fine pipette, which was blown into the superficial wound, and then a plaster dressing was applied over.
And what were the risks of infection?
Providing everything was sterile, very little. But this is the thing: if you got an infection creeping in, it wasn't done properly, you did get occasional.
Would you get a reaction to the smallpox, to the actual cowpox, to the lymph? Would it make people ill anyway?
No, it wouldn't. No. The tetanus toxoid, that gave people sort of some reaction toward the toxoid, towards the tetanus itself. That's what it was meant to do, to produce antigens in the bloodstream.
But that didn't happen with the smallpox thing.
It did, but it didn't give any secondary emotion. No.
You couldn't tell it was happening.
You couldn't.
Now, how are the tetanus injections given?
By in injection needles, syringe. Yeah.
Into your upper arm.
Into the deltoid muscle, the upper arm muscle. And the man was right-handed, they gave it in his left arm, and vice versa, of course, just to lessen the chance of incapacitation.
And what about changing needles? Or
the needle was changed every time. We had a crucible, boiling water, the needles constantly being boiled, and to sterilise, you have to boil needles for 5 minutes. And then the new needle was reinserted in the syringe each time. I did the changing needles, the doctor did the injections, except of course when the doctor's turn to become injected, and I did it.